This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It comes around every year, whether you like it and celebrate it with flowers and chocolate and other things, or revile and ignore it. At least try to ignore it. Valentine's Day is this Sunday. We're not going to pretend that this is a great holiday for everyone, but it is a time to reflect on our relationships, to think about what makes them succeed or fail, and to spend a few moments on ourselves. Our guest today says the most important relationship you have is with yourself, after all. So tell us about your relationship hang-ups, how you work on self-love, and what you're doing for Valentine's Day. Post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In the studio with me now is Bjarne Holmes. He's associate professor and director of Champlain College's psychology program, and he has a podcast called Relationship Matters. Bjarne, welcome back to the program.
Jane, thank you for having me back on.
How do you feel about Valentine's Day?
Well, last year I said about I'm too romantic for Valentine's Day. I think that stands the same. I love it, you know, but I basically treat every day focused on love, I think.
So you're not doing anything special?
I am not doing anything special.
We got a note from Megan who says, many years ago, I embraced Valentine's Day as a day to remind people that I love them rather than the holiday's emphasis on relationships. I send out Valentine's instead of Christmas cards, and it's become my favorite holiday, made even more poignant because my dad passed away on Valentine's Day 15 years ago. We've invited older neighbors or a group of single friends over for dinner on Valentine's Day, and Megan suggests if you're uncomfortable with the mushy side of the day, seize it and make your own. What's wrong with yet another chance to celebrate love and friendship?
That's really good advice.
So if people don't feel warm and fuzzy, how do you suggest they sort of frame this day in their minds? Because sometimes Valentine's Day or a holiday that reminds you of something you don't have can feel really bad.
Well, I know later in the program we're going to talk a little bit about how some people might feel a little uncomfortable because there is this notion around Valentine's Day to be focused very much on romantic love and coupledom as sort of the right way. And for those people that maybe don't fit into sort of a very narrow perspective around that, Valentine's Day could feel a little bit painful. But I would say around Valentine's Day is to broaden your focus on love. I mean, broaden your focus on love around friendships, around family, around neighbors. It's an opportunity for community. So I think if we come at it from that perspective, it can be sort of more pro-social for everybody.
So we are going to reframe this from a Hallmark holiday about jewelry and chocolate to a day or at least a program where we can think positively and helpfully about relationships and love and self-love. And I'm sure most people or many people think, all right, if I could just find the key to making relationships work, I'd be in great shape. So, Bjarne Holmes, what's the key? What's the one key to making relationship work?
Well, let's back up a second and let's get to that. So make sure I remember to answer that question.
Well, that question was a joke, man.
Let's back up 1 second first. Because there is this fixation a little bit that which I think Valentine's in the more stereotypical way kind of emphasizes that if you can just find the quote unquote right partner out there, then you're going to have a, you know, successful relationship. And to the contrary, that if somehow you don't manage to find the right quote unquote person for you, then somehow you're going to be doomed to unhappiness. And that's the painful component that is carried with Valentine's Day. But I would say finding a partner in life or finding a relational situation that is going to work for you is just the beginning, frankly. And what comes after that is what's going to determine whether you have well-being, whether you have success in a relationship, however you define that. And what we do know, to answer your question, is that the number one thing that predicts the most happiness over life in terms of a relationship is your ability to fight fairly.
Yeah, let's talk about that because it seems like the obvious thing would be avoid conflict because if you have harmony, isn't that going to make for a better relationship? But what you found and what the research tells us is that this conflict is really important, but it's how you deal with it. So what does that mean, how you actually fight fairly?
Well, you're not going to have deeper levels of intimacy. And I'm sure that most of our listeners agree with us. You're not going to have deeper levels of intimacy unless you compromise on some things, unless you, when you get close to a person, you are going to have disagreements. That is part of being close to another human being. So the question then is, what do you do with that? And what I would like to do today is take an opportunity to teach Vermont a little bit about what we have known in relationship science for a long time, but particularly Dr. John Gottman, who now is retired but previously was working at the University of Washington, has sort of a classic paradigm of about 45 years worth of research that clearly shows what he calls what the masters of relationships do versus the disasters of relationships.
And?
Okay, so I'm going to go through these sort of step by step. So he has a couple of things that when you have a disagreement or when you have a fight, he calls the four horsemen of apocalypse, okay? And it's really interesting because what his research group was able to do towards the end is they were able to spend as little as 60 seconds of asking couples in the lab to have try to resolve a disagreement. And you can spend as little as 60 seconds. They needed 60 seconds to be able to tell where the discussion was going to go. And from how the discussion ended up, they could predict with almost 80% accuracy whether you're still married a couple of years later or not. So what are those four horsemen of apocalypse, the bad things? And we'll talk about the good things in a second. Well, quickly, they're criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. So what I would like to do is try to go through what each one of those are.
Sure.
So criticism, first of all, is it is what it sounds like. It's basically name-calling. It's when you get very emotional. It's swearing. It's the stuff that borders on what a lot of us call slightly abusive. The second really major one that you see in the disasters, the people where you can predict with pretty good accuracy that they're not going to be happy together over time or they're going to break up, is contempt. Contempt is this notion that in a disagreement, you approach your partner kind of with the idea that you're just a little bit better than they are. So you're like, well, I understand how to do this just a little bit better than you do, so let me teach you how to be a better person.
That's not a good thing.
And it really isn't a good thing, and it's a very good predictor of relationship breakup, or it's a very good predictor of being unhappy over time, because there's a lot of couples out there that are in relationships and are unhappy. Okay? Defensiveness, the third really big horseman of the apocalypse, is one that I've probably struggled with myself actually in life. But defensiveness is this, and it's probably the trickiest one to get over. Somebody has to give in a fight. Think about it. You have a disagreement. It's very easy to say, you know, I could say, Jane, you didn't do this. You're really bad at this. Blah, right? Mm-hmm. Or I could come at it from an approach of, look, here's how I feel about something. We have a mutual problem. And how can we both work to improve that? Those are very different approaches. The first one is going to put you automatically in a feeling of I'm being attacked, mm-hmm. in which case you're most likely to respond with an attack back, or at least you're most likely to respond with some sort of defensiveness. So the typical response would be, you're not very good at this, you never do this, and maybe the response is back to me from you would be, well, what about this thing you did a year ago? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? And that's never really going to lead to anything particularly productive. So the problem with that defensiveness strategy is that, again, somebody has to give a little bit. And that's what's really hard to do. It's very hard because your partner might have a legitimate criticism. It's just that they're delivering it to you in a way that isn't particularly nice. But at some point, somebody has to go, you know what? I'm listening to you. Honey, tell me more. I'm listening. I hear what you're saying. You know, inside you're like boiling up. You're like, why can't you just be nice to me about that? I hear what you're saying. Teach me how to be a better person. Mm-hmm. Show me how I can do that differently. And what you'll notice with that strategy is you almost always de-escalate the situation entirely. So that's a hard one to work on. Stonewalling is a fourth one. And you do see this more in men than women. Stonewalling is basically what it sounds like. It's just shutting down emotionally. And John Gottman likes to sort of give this example that of stonewalling is sort of like, okay, the football game's about to come on in 10 minutes. And the guy is sitting there going like, oh my God, I've got 10 more minutes. What do I do? If I just ride this out for 10 more minutes, once the game's on, well, that's it. She's got to leave me alone then. So shutting down like that emotionally also is a very bad predictor or a very good predictor of the relationship coming to an end. What you see in men that do it is internally, their physiological systems are hyper aroused. So it's not really that it helps them. They're still super stressed out.
And you just said men. Is it something that happens more in men?
You do see stonewalling more in men, but it's not that it applies necessarily across, in perfectly in that way. And I don't even know if I like talking about men and women of the gender binary anyway. So,
so you know, if those are good predictors of relationships that are likely to go south, do couples who worry that they exhibit some of these tendencies when they fight have reason to think, well, we're just doomed then? I mean, does this mean that the relationship was not a good pairing from the start, so there's no way to recover because this is just an indicator of something that was bad from the beginning? Or are there ways to actually improve the way you argue and maybe keep a good relationship or save something?
So I have good and bad news for you, Jane, because the answer is a little bit of both. Sadly, I mean, there's sort of a myth out there that there's a 7-year sort of, if you've been together 7 years, then your relationship's kind of tested. That's not really true. What actually, unfortunately, sadly, is the best predictor of you breaking up over time is time itself. In other words, sadly, this is the problem out there, is that the more people are together, the more they start irritating each other. And the reason for that is because people just don't know, they don't have these skills of how to problem solve in their relationship effectively. And what they do is they often build up resentment over time. So they might get past something, but it's not really, really resolved. They just keep going. And then there are other things in their life, like kids and stuff like that, that kind of distract. And that's why you see a lot of people break up after the kids leave the house, because they're sort of, then they just have each other again, and those problems that were there in to begin with never go away. So in some essence, if you don't work on these relational skills a lot, then with time it will just get harder. The positive thing is that you can work on these relationship skills and you can improve.
Let's go to a call. We have a caller on the line with us, Andrea, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Andrea. I'd love to hear your thoughts today.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. While your guest was talking about relationship and how important that is, it definitely is. But the other thing that I am thinking about this year for Valentine's is I find myself newly single, and it's going to be a day of self-love for me. And I'm just going to celebrate that, and I'm also going to gather some of my other single girlfriends, and we're just going to have a night where we're just going to celebrate each other. And you can't have a successful relationship unless you love yourself first.
Andrea, thanks for sharing that. I hope the night is fabulous, and congratulations to you on figuring out what you're going to do and having a positive way to deal with being newly single. What do you think about that, Bjarne Holmes?
Andrea, I think that's great. I mean, frankly, when we talk to people about success in relationships, it's often a complaint they have first about something with a partner. And what we kind of, in a very subtle way, try to do sometimes is get them to realize that often the work that they put into themselves, that relationship with themselves, figuring that part out then often translates for them to be able to take those same things they figured about themselves and solve that with another person. And by the way, what is wrong with being single?
Right.
Hello? Like, in our society today, and it's so interesting because it seems to be more of a focus on women sometimes, that somehow if you reach a certain age and you haven't found, you know, a male in your life in particular, you know, that's going to help you, what is it, like you're going to complete you as a woman? Is that it? I mean, that's not a very good message that we're sending to our children if we send that message. And that's one that we certainly should rebuke. And there are, you know, good things out there like the Alternatives to Marriage Project. There are good alternatives. And we should celebrate all forms of relationship status, including singlehood.
Well, that's where we're going to go next. We're going to talk a little bit about these different ways that we can have relationships, including being single or being monogamish or being open and polyandrous or just having a relationship that you craft a little bit more to what you and your partner want. We're going to talk about that. We're going to take more of your calls and emails. You can tell us what stymies you in your relationships or what you think makes them run at peak performance. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Bjarne Holmes is an associate professor and director of Champlain College's psychology program. He's also the director of the LOVES Initiative research and advocacy team, which we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes. And if you have a question for him, or if you want to share your own story of finding love, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note or a question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And Bjarne, we did get a note and a personal story from Chuck, who says, I find your topics generally relevant, but this one really strikes home. My wife died a few years ago, not long after completing a log palace on our land in the National Forest. Off the grid on a stream in what the Eye on the Sky boys call a normally colder mountain hollow. The locale is gorgeous, and although lonely, I love it. The challenges, to me, are relatively minor, and I accept being responsible for my way of life, cutting wood, maintaining the power system, and the work one must do to sustain this lifestyle. I consider physical activity to be healthy and need to live in a place where life pushes back. At 65, I am neither young nor middle-aged. Was it Rod Stewart who sang, "I've got to try to love again"? The challenge seems twofold, not only to be on the same page with someone you can't get enough of, but who would revel in this lifestyle as well. And I encourage your suggestions. So, Bjarne, do you have any suggestions for Chuck who wants to find love, but something that will fit with the lifestyle he has that he also loves?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people are out there looking for love in various ways. And if you think about it, sometimes the very best relationships that we develop with people are with people that already are our friends. So I guess what I would say is start with friendship. Focus on the love. It's not necessarily romantic love. Focus on the love that you can have from friendships. And I think if you have that as a basis, it's something else might turn up in your life.
And let's go to Bill in South Hero. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. My wife and I are celebrating our 52nd wedding anniversary this year. And we have two boys, and I told them when they got married, there's 3 days that you need to remember every year. Her birthday, the Valentine's Day, and can't think.
Well, Bill, you've got two pretty good ones there anyway.
Okay.
You've got to remember her birthday and Valentine's Day.
And your anniversary. And your anniversary.
Never forget that one.
That's right. And then what I do every year at Valentine's Day is I write her a poem. And she has kept those all these years, and they're all in a book. And you read back through those, and it's the history of our marriage, of all the hard times and easy times and wonderful times.
Bill, that sounds really lovely, and you certainly are a true romantic. Thank you for calling in and sharing your thoughts. I really appreciate that, and I hope that this year's poem is a good one. Eric is calling in from Colchester. Hi, Eric. You've got a question or a thought?
Yes. Hi, Jane. I'm also an instructor at Champlain College, and I just had a very simple question. I'm more of a writing instructor, so I'm always trying to define things, and I was very interested in hearing if Bjarne can define, or how does psychology, in his view today, define exactly what love is, because I think that's also maybe the most essential question.
Eric, are you a plant? Did Bjarne know you were going to call in and ask him this?
No, I'm not a plant.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Certainly not a paid plant.
Eric, we're going to have to sit down for about an hour or 2 hours to talk about that, because we have in psychology probably about, I mean, there, we have a lot of models, and we don't think of it as love. We break it up probably into about 10 or 11 different types of love that all sort of fit into each other in different ways. I think that I would bore, honestly, most of Vermont if I got into the technicalities of that. But I would certainly be happy to sit down over coffee and talk about it seriously.
So, but in all honesty, there is no easy definition.
No,
of what
there's
love is.
Absolutely no easy definition. There's a lot of debate too, like on exactly how you define love. I think from a scientist's perspective, it's kind of like a meteorologist. Sorry, I'm not saying that word right, but it's like a weather person would look at snow, and they might get interested in many different types of snow in nuance, whereas the everyday person would just say snow.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we certainly, you know, when somebody says what is love, I'm like, what kind of love? Because there's many different types of love, and they are come in. Yeah, so the, yeah, it's a complex answer.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I sort of jokingly asked you at the beginning, you know, what's the one key to making a relationship work? And obviously, you know, there's no one key, but as you said, there are some things that we know about what makes relationships successful or not successful. But, you know, if you read the advice columns or the top 20 things that'll make your relationship better in a glossy magazine, they often seem really predicated on certain types of relationships or a really traditional model of romantic love and partnership. And you mentioned, you know, the gender binary, and they're often heterosexual relationships that are based on monogamy and these very traditional roles. It doesn't seem like that's where everybody is, certainly not these days. And maybe we have a greater tolerance or a greater acceptance of different kinds of relationships and even different kinds of marriages.
Jane, I'm glad you bring that up. I'm not sure we've ever been there. I mean, we know from back in the, you know, Kinsey days that people are doing a lot more complicated stuff, both relationally and sexually, than they're necessarily talking about. It's just become a little bit more, we've become more comfortable with it in our society recently. I run a research and an advocacy group at Champlain College called the LOVES Initiative, and LOVE stands for Love, Openness, Validation, Equality, Sexuality. I think what we are really, really trying to do is not to promote any type of orientation to how you approach relationships, but to rather say that it is becoming more acceptable in our society to focus on designing your relationship to fit your values, your needs, who you are. And that comes into terms with your sexuality. That comes into terms with you know, things that are not on the gender binary. That comes into terms of alternatives to monogamy. We know that about 4 to 5%, this is an estimate across that quite a few researchers have done in the United States, live today in some type of what we call consensual non-monogamy, meaning that they have, that could be anything from people that are focused on recreational sex, like swinging, to people that have open relationships of the sort of a don't ask, don't tell type of relationship, to polyamory, which is basically consensual, committed relationships, sometimes structured amongst partners, sometimes structured amongst triads. The typical thing we see quite often is two men and a woman living together, sometimes structured in quads of four, sometimes in networks of people, very much with a focus often on love more than a focus on sex.
And you're actually doing studies on polyamory.
Yeah. Yeah. We have one sample with 3,500 people. We have also done in-depth sort of interviews around the country. And the thing is, again, there is a discrepancy between private life and public life, because there is a lot of people that are in some form of a consensual non-monogamy relationship, and they are shy about it, because we also have quite a lot. Well, we don't, but Amy Morris, for instance, a researcher, Terry Connolly, Bill Chopik, they all have work that shows very carefully that, you know, society isn't necessarily that open to these kind of things on the same hand. And there's a lot of threat. People feel scared about these. The same way that people who were lesbian or gay or bisexual 30 years ago might have said, I don't know if this is something I want to talk about because I'm going to feel, you know, that other people are scared of this. It's basically this, I'd say the same thing with a lot of consensual non-monogamy today, that people aren't necessarily open about it.
We got a note that's sort of tangentially related, not fully related, but Joseph in Essex Junction wants to know, how should one ask a new lover if they are casually dating several other people?
How should you ask them?
Yeah, I guess that's
straight
his
out.
Question.
You
yeah.
ask them straight out. Like, there is no way that you can do something better than to just be forthright with a question. You can obviously frame it. You can obviously explain why it's important to you to know it. But the, you know, there's the honest and straightforward approach is always going to be the best one.
In this idea of designing your own relationship, which, you know, as you point out, Bjarne, is something we've always done. I mean, there have always been different kinds of relationships, different kinds of marriages, whether they're out in the open or not. But in terms of now thinking really strategically, as you get into a relationship, look, I know I have needs. I know that these are the needs I have, or these are the desires that I have, and I want somebody who can meet me and whose desires I can also help fulfill. You know, do you ever actually get everything that you think when you're going in? You know, this is what I'm going to get out of a relationship, because it seems to me when two or more people are coming together to form a relationship, it's always some sort of compromise.
Right. I mean, even the relationship with yourself is a bit of a compromise, right? But no, absolutely. I think what we're trying to do is to promote people to be as authentic as possible, promote people to explore themselves and allow themselves to explore themselves and not just sort of go autopilot through life in terms of, I'm going to get into this type of relationship and I've never really thought about it. You know, in other words, I don't care personally. I don't care like what people get into or what they do or how they live their lives or how they identify. What I do care about, because I think our society is better for it, is if people are intentional about what they do. If they think through, like, who am I? What are my needs? How do I succeed with those needs? Who are the people that I want in my life? And how do I structure my sexuality, my relationships? And that we also become more tolerant and say, you know what? As long as it's between consenting adults, what does it matter? If love is the focus, if people are happy, what does it matter? You know, there was a really interesting study that just came out, a review paper by Rubel and colleagues in the Journal of Sex Research that is looking at this question of, like, well, what about the quality of consensually non-monogamous relationships versus more traditional monogamous relationships? You know, or who's more satisfied and who communicates better and all these kind of things. And pretty much what the conclusion of the sort of 5 years of research on this is that there isn't really a big difference. We're kind of equally unhappy or happy, no matter like sort of what kind of relationship structure we have around us.
We got a note from Scott in West Fairley who says, I'm a life coach who focuses on relationship issues specifically with gay men. As a gay man in a 27-year relationship, I can tell you that sustaining a relationship is much more about commitment than anything else. The commitment not to leave when times get rough, but to figure a way to recharge the relationship. The commitment to fall in love again. From my perspective, many couples seem to think that relationships are static, but they, like all things in life, are always changing. Bjarne, what have you found in looking at this whole body of research about what actually makes people in relationships successful or those relationships successful?
Well, let's go back for a second then to what Jagatma was talking about. I appreciate that comment on commitment, actually, quite a lot. It's interesting because if you actually look at what the literature is showing somewhat on, say, polyamorous people, what you sometimes find is those are people that are committed to stay in their relationship even more so than the monogamous people, because it's sort of like, okay, so my I don't necessarily have a spouse who likes to dance, but you know what? I can still go dancing with somebody else. And so it's sort of, in some ways, it kind of eases their tension on relying on one person to be everything, right? But if we look more globally at all types of relationship, what John Gottman said, so remember what we talked about before, we talked about the disasters.
Mm-hmm.
So what was almost more interesting in his work is, what did the masters of relationships do? So this is people who are successful in relationships a very long time. And by successful, I don't mean just staying together. I mean that they're happy.
And that's through self-reporting?
It's through self-reporting, but it's also more through observation and analyzing sort of their relationships and what they do. And what you noticed a lot is what the masters do, particularly when they fight, is they fight with care. Because it's during the fighting that you produce the scars. And it's during the fighting that you produce sort of that deep tissue scar that then sits there years later and just hurts and creates a little bit of resentment. Think of fighting, Jane, kind of as tossing an egg back and forth. If you can approach fighting as if you're tossing an issue back and forth and you need to not drop the egg, if you can take that kind of care, then you're fighting well. What they often do is they think of a relationship over time as building microculture. That's something I would say. And I think Bill's example about, you know, every Valentine's Day writing a poem, that's building microculture. That's building friendship over time. That's something that you notice in the masters. They do very, very well. So, for instance, when things do get complicated in a relationship, what you often notice is that the people that have focused on building up those that friendship and that emotional context, they are much, much better when things get hard at feeling, well, things might be hard right now, but globally, overall, I feel pretty good about this relationship. And hence, I'm going to sort of forgive my partner for what they did.
And that, too, is something that you can work on. You can work on having that care in conflict.
You can, because what I almost call it is investing into the emotion bank. That's what John Gottman said, is when you have a discussion, it's paying attention to your partner. It's turning toward them. It's interviewing your partner, maybe annually, maybe every Valentine's Day you should sit down and say, honey, what's important to you in your life right now? You know, I've known you for 20 years, but I haven't actually asked you for what are your life ambitions and goals right now? What would you like to do? And when you do that kind of stuff, you build on that friendship model. And building on that friendship model is what you rely on when things get tough.
That's Bjarne Holmes. He's an associate professor and director of Champlain College's psychology program. His podcast is called Relationship Matters. We'll put a link at vpr.net. Bjarne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, how are school boards feeling now that the legislature has amended the spending threshold rules that were supposed to be in place for the budgets being voted on in a few weeks? We'll find out next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One of the most controversial provisions of Act 46, the education bill passed by the legislature last year, were the caps that limited what schools could spend in their new budgets. School boards objected vociferously, and the legislature promised to make some kind of adjustment when it got back in session. That adjustment was voted through on January 30th, and it did raise the spending thresholds and remove some penalties for overspending. But many school boards remain frustrated by the process. And here to tell us more is Nicole Mace, Executive Director of the Vermont School Boards Association. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jane.
Can you recap for us a little bit more specifically what changes were made to Act 46 to accommodate budgeting needs?
Sure. The legislature increased the thresholds that each district had for its target by 0.9 percentage points. It also exempted low-spending districts, so districts that spent below the average per pupil spending for the prior fiscal year were exempted from the thresholds. And it also allowed districts to use the target threshold that was most advantageous to them. The Agency of Education had published target thresholds in August that were then recalculated in January, which added some confusion to the process. So part of the tweak made in S-233 was to allow districts not to be disadvantaged by that change in calculation.
And S-233 is what was being voted on. It became Act 65 when it was signed
into
law.
That's correct. That's correct.
So these changes then, are they good? I mean, is this what school boards were hoping for?
So I think for most school districts, the changes the legislature made to the allowable growth provision came after they had finalized their budgets. One district has shared with me, and I think it reflects the general statements I'm hearing from folks, that the adjustments that were made by the legislature were far too late for the board and community to consider in a well-thought-out way. So in November, legislative leaders recognized that the provision needed revision in order to respond to an unanticipated 7.9% health insurance increase. And boards were really hoping for a speedy resolution of the issue so that they could finalize their budgets with some certainty. And the four-week legislative debate, sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry.
You're in an office environment. Live radio.
The four-week legislative debate frustrated board members and administrators as they worked to complete their budgets accurately.
But, Nicole, as I understand it, many school boards wrote up their budgets assuming there would be a fix like this. So their budgets are in line with what they wanted, not what Act 46 had mandated. So, I mean, is the frustration a little bit over the top? They essentially got what they wanted.
Well, certainly districts express relief to the extent they are now not subject to the threshold or penalties. They have expressed relief. The 0.9 percentage point increase was on the table fairly early in the session. But I'm not aware of a pattern where districts were counting on changes. The sense I get from boards is that they developed budgets with the best information they had at the time and that they believe met student needs, fulfilled contract obligations, and to the extent they could, avoided tax penalties on their communities. So one district I heard from did see their tax increase drop from 33 cents to 22 cents. That district, clearly a 22-cent increase isn't a good thing, but they were relieved to see a drop of 11 cents in their tax rate. But the most common reaction from districts right now that I'm hearing is that the General Assembly's process really failed to consider the timing of the local process and the role of local school officials. Mm.
Do you have a sense of how many schools, sort of as they were preparing their budgets, and as you said, they tried to budget in the best interests of their school districts and in towns, but do you have a sense of how many budgeted sort of within the confines of Act 46 as it stood, and how many were going to be over the thresholds one way or another before this tweak was made?
I know that all I know is the information that had been shared in the General Assembly. So we hadn't done polling specifically of our members. And my understanding was that over 100 districts were anticipated to exceed the threshold through the normal budgeting process. I don't know the extent to which that played out in terms of the final decisions that were made. I know the Agency of Education is still completing the process of going through all the numbers that have been submitted by boards. And we should have better information over the next week or so from the agency.
Do you expect any repercussions on town meeting day as townspeople look at what the school budgets are that could come from this process? Or, I mean, is it likely to be smooth sailing in as much as school budgeting is ever smooth sailing on town meeting day?
I'm not sure it will be smooth sailing. I think one of the unanticipated consequences of this discussion is that numbers have changed fairly frequently throughout the process because of the lateness in the action that was taken by the General Assembly. Town reports have been submitted for printing, and the numbers that are in those reports may no longer be accurate. So many board members feel that going into town meeting, their credibility is on the line because they have shared information with their communities that may no longer be accurate. So there's a communications challenge that many of them are, you know, meeting head on and trying to do their best to explain why there might be differences in terms of the numbers they relied on earlier. And they continue to be concerned that the legislature will make further changes through the tax rate setting process, so that process hasn't yet concluded, and that the outcome of that conversation will create more confusion in their communities. So it's hard to say, to predict what the result on town meeting day will be, but certainly boards are feeling at a disadvantage as they go into those conversations because they haven't been as clear as they would like to be with their communities.
Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens, but I really appreciate you telling us a little bit more about what you're hearing from school boards around the state as they look at the tweaks that were made in Act 46 and as we approach town meeting day when townspeople will be voting on their school budgets. Nicole Mace is Executive Director of the Vermont School Boards Association. Nicole, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And finally, today we'll read some of your comments that you've sent us after recent programs. Joining me is Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Jane. Yesterday we looked at the results from Tuesday's primary election in New Hampshire. Laura wrote to us, "The media coverage of this presidential race is overwhelmingly focused on campaign strategy and who is where in which polls. I wish there was more coverage that explained the actual differences between candidates and that helped the public really understand what they are actually choosing between and the long-term implications of each candidate's policy goals. Instead, it just feels like we're getting constant popularity contest updates, and what good does that do for anyone?"
And Elizabeth in Burlington emailed us today writing, "I supported Hillary until Bernie got in the race. Once he entered, that was a game changer. The key difference I find between them is humility. Bernie has it. Hillary's been disconnected from the average American experience for too long, or maybe she never had it in the first place."
But Allen had some criticism for Senator Sanders' candidacy, writing, "I grew up in New York City with socialist parents. I also attended the University of Chicago. I like Bernie inherently, but he's so far speaking in naive terms. The U.S. economy is too intimately tied into China's, India's, Germany's, etc., to say that he can save the American middle class without considering what is going on elsewhere in the world. I want Bernie to start talking in realistic terms."
Yesterday, we also covered the debate over a trial plan to redesign the lanes on a section of North Avenue, a major road in Burlington that passes through the New North End neighborhood. Patrick in Burlington shared these thoughts. "As a New North End resident, it's distressing to see excessive speeding on North Avenue, speeding which tends to carry onto neighborhood streets throughout the New North End, preventing kids from walking to schools and making older folks think twice about crossing to get to a local park or shopping center. This debate is more about attitude and values than it is about anything else. Those in favor of the pilot program want a more vibrant, connected community via safe neighborhood streets. Those against it would rather not have their commute time increase by 3 minutes.
And Stephen wrote, "I'm glad Jane asked about whether this controversy is indicative of other splits in the community. From my perspective, that of someone who does not live in Burlington but has friends in Burlington across a broad cultural spectrum, the controversy immediately struck me as a proxy for a larger cultural struggle between old, conservative, and new, progressive Burlingtonians."
On Tuesday, we discussed how the warm winter weather has affected Vermont's economy. Rob in Castleton posted this comment, "The state needs to find alternate sources of income, as opposed to basing the majority of its income on tourism. We residents wind up picking up the slack. It isn't our fault, nor is it the responsibility of residents to make up any deficit in the state coffers due to a slow tourism season. Nor should we have to face reductions in services. An industry-based income would do the state well."
We always love hearing from you about the show. Keep your comments coming to vermontedition@vpr.net or post them on our Facebook page.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome, Jane.
And we are still getting comments on our earlier discussion about love and relationships. Mark says, "In my own experience, success in romance comes from both parties being open from the start. Being on the same page about expectations, fears, hopes, etc., goes a long way towards having a successful relationship. It's never a 50-50 split because in a successful relationship, both parties give 100%. If you missed our earlier discussion, you can find it at vpr.net/Vermont Edition, where you can listen back to any of our programs. And if you like the show but sometimes miss it, be sure to podcast us wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for today. Tomorrow, Governor Shumlin's proposal to switch to an all-payer model for health care would overhaul how care is paid for in Vermont. We'll talk about how it would work and what the challenges are. Send your questions or comments, as usual, to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.